All food was to be provided from the cooler, and whoever rode shotgun got to control the radio, and was also responsible for making the driver's sandwich to his or her specifications. Bill had procured 4 empty 2-liter bottles, individually labeled them, and placed them behind the back seat for urinary emergencies. Our plan actually worked surprisingly well, and the first 24 hours of driving passed uneventfully. I was behind the wheel at about midnight and merged from I-64 onto I-70 as we crossed over the Mississippi River into Missouri. Bill kneeled on the seat beside me, gazing up, his whole upper body out the window, drinking in the gorgeous Gateway Arch of St. Louis. As we turned north and passed right under it, the full moon lit it from above, perfectly complementing the floodlights below. When Bill finally sat back down as we turned west out of Old North St. Louis, he said thoughtfully and without even a whiff of irony, "This is a beautiful country." I waited a minute or so and then answered, "Yes, it is." Behind us, everyone else in the van was asleep. 5 hours later, the sun rose at our backs and slowly opened a door of light onto the endless windswept fields of Kansas. "This is a beautiful country," Bill said again quietly to himself, and again I answered him, "Yes, it is." We arrived at Calvin, Cal, and Linda's home in Greeley around dinner time the next day, piling out of the van like a pack of tired hunting dogs coming home after a long chase. I had telephoned before we left Atlanta to tell them that we were coming, but had presumed upon their surrogate parentage that I'd be welcome and could bring friends. I wasn't wrong. Cal and Linda had both been teachers for decades and loved me better than I deserved. We stretched our legs, came inside, and hungrily accepted the warm food that they offered.
"So what brings you through northern Colorado during December?" asked Cal in his offhanded way.
"We couldn't find a map for Texas," Bill answered, and I had no choice but to shrug my validation of his explanation. Linda found a bed for each of us within their huge barn of a house, and we all slept like rocks for 10 hours. Bill and I were the first to emerge the next morning. Cal invited us to walk over to the neighborhood coffee shop, and we accepted enthusiastically. As we drank our coffee, I told Cal about my plan to drive up to Laramie, over to Salt Lake City, then on to Reno and up over the Sierra Nevada, and finally down into Sacramento and across to the Bay Area, all in the next day and a half. Cal had grown up on a cattle ranch during the 1940s and was a steady man of few words. He listened and nodded his understanding and then advised me in a measured tone. "There's a big storm coming in. You might want to take I-70 through Grand Junction in order to avoid the divide." "No, I don't, because that's longer," I said, and then boasted, "I've already calculated it."
"Well, not much longer, if it is at all," Cal replied, though good-naturedly. Determined to win what I saw as an argument, I insisted,
"No, I'll show you when we get home." We unfurled the maps of Colorado, Wyoming, and Utah, and used a string to compare the two routes. With victorious satisfaction, I was able to show that the string was ever so slightly shorter when it was laid up over Cheyenne. Cal just shook his head and asked us if we had chains in the van. I explained for the 10th time that no, we didn't need any of that stuff because I had grown up in Minnesota. Cal shook his head again, went outside onto the porch, and stared at the northwestern sky for a while. "Of all the regrets of my life, Winning that game with the string features prominently among them. My route was indeed shorter, all of 60 miles shorter than Cal's. A single hour of driving. That's what I thought I was avoiding by hurtling us headlong into the worst winter storm of the 1990s. As we reloaded the van, Cal and Linda's 8-year-old daughter, Olivia, decorated the inside with the crayon-colored flags that she had copied from the World Atlas. While we hugged goodbye, I thought briefly about how I was always leaving the few people in the world who loved me. And then I shook it off and got behind the wheel. My job was to drive to Rawlins, Wyoming, after which Terry would take over and get us to Evanston, just near where we would cross into Utah. As I drove, I heard Bill and Terry bickering about the deli, Bill's name for our cooler of food, which was by now a couple of inches of cold water with bologna floating in it and a few chunks of residual ice propping up some soggy cheese. It stank so horribly that Terry was pushing for a new rule. Its lid could be opened only when two or more people wanted something inside, and even then only with the windows open. I sympathized with Terry, knowing full well that the stench was hardly going to improve in the next 2 days, but I felt obligated to side with Bill, as he was the only one of us who was still actually eating from the cooler. Because of the fight, everyone, maybe even Noah too, was in a sour mood when we stopped at a gas station on the west side of Rawlins so that Terry could take over the driving. While I was waiting for everyone to finish in the bathroom, I stood and stared at the horizon, noting that the sky looked awfully dark for 1 p.m. I could also feel the temperature plummeting as the wind picked up. Terry came out of the gas station and climbed into the driver's seat, and I asked her to tap on the horn to signal to the others that we were ready to roll. Bill and Noah jumped into the back seats, and Terry started the engine. I was tired and bored, though the day was still young, and the map that I was holding made the road ahead look flat and uninteresting. I took off my boots and put my bare feet up against the heaters on the dashboard. I thought about putting my seatbelt on, but then decided against it. This was the flattest place on earth. What could possibly happen? As we merged onto I-80, Terry pressed forcefully on the accelerator, and the van sped forward as if she were joining the commuter rat race on the Atlanta Beltway. I shifted in my seat uneasily but said nothing for a mile or so. The very moment that we crossed the Great Divide, the weather changed drastically and I saw flurries starting to come down. I looked at the wet road and realized that in the next few minutes it would become slick with ice. I looked at Terry and realized that her plan was just to keep ramming on the gas pedal and maintain 80 miles per hour. I spoke in the calm and steady voice that I use to instruct students while they are immersed in a dangerous and complicated laboratory procedure. Okay, so it's going to get really icy here, and you're going to want to slow way down. I didn't get to finish my sentence, because instead of gradually slowing down, Terry had popped on the brake, and finding the road icy indeed, slammed down even harder until the brakes locked up. When we started to slide, she compensated wildly with the steering wheel, and the van began waltzing in big, swinging fishtails as it flew forward. Terry was screaming at this point, having fully lost control of the vehicle, and I realized with horror that there was no way this was not going to end in some kind of crash. The last upright thing that I saw was the speed limit sign snapping like a popsicle stick as the van managed to hit the one single vertical object within a 10-mile radius of where we were. We spun around and around, and when we finally slowed, we were facing backward into the oncoming traffic. My terror that another car would hit us was overtaken by a sickening awareness that the van was more than leaning to one side. It had begun to tip over. I tried to brace myself against the dashboard as I felt us slowly roll sideways into the ditch, accompanied by the sickening crunching sound of metal, the clattering of plastic, Terry's high-pitched shrieks, and what sounded like the fire of musket balls that heralded the first volley of the Civil War. I was amazed at how slowly everything seemed to be happening, like a roller coaster going over the tallest peak of the ride. My head hit the cool glass of the window, and then bumped and rested against the thin felt covering of the van's ceiling. All at once we were profoundly at rest. I opened my eyes and stood up awkwardly, the ceiling now serving as the floor. The other three passengers hung upside down like parachuters, effectively suspended by their seatbelts. I commenced running back and forth on the ceiling of the van, trying to check on everyone. Miraculously, we were all uninjured, save for my bloody nose, which gushed with vigor when I started to laugh hysterically. Bill was the first to unfasten his seatbelt and fall ungracefully to the ceiling, and I noted that he didn't seem much fazed by the whole thing. Noah was in the far back, morosely wiping his grungy hipster hairdo with both hands. Terry simply hung there, looking dejected. I started to worry that the van might blow up, since this is what always happens in the movies after a crash, but I wasn't sure what to do about it. Suddenly the back doors of the van flew open, and a man's voice announced, "I'm a veterinarian. Is everyone okay?" Apparently the car behind us had watched us go into the ditch, and the driver had pulled over to help. I could hardly contain my relief. I was ready to throw my arms around the guy and kiss him. "Hey, yeah, we're fine," I beamed. "Weather's getting worse. Let's get you all into town." I looked past our new friend and saw a second set of Good Samaritans ease toward us, hazard lights flashing. "Okay," I agreed happily. "Let's do it." The men helped us out, and I was the last to leave, more because I had to dig my boots out of the van's spectacularly dispersed contents than because I was the captain of our capsized ship. We jumped into their trucks in pairs and drove off toward who knew where. We didn't know the drivers, and we didn't know where we were. We didn't have any vehicle, any money, or any real plan, and I felt awesome. I was so glad to be alive that I thought my heart would burst through my chest. I was so grateful that nobody was hurt that I wanted to sing out at the top of my lungs. Whatever came next, no matter what it was going to be a gift that I could never hope to deserve. I looked back as we drove away and saw Olivia's flags fluttering across the ditch and onto the road. The yellow cross of Jamaica on its field of black and green caught my eye, and I smiled as I watched it scamper off into the distance. 20 minutes later, we were dumped off at a filling station on Spruce Street in West Rawlins. I thanked our rescuers profusely, and the more I talked, the more I could sense that they just wanted to get out of there. Terry looked positively suicidal, sulking darkly on the outskirts of the group. One of the men took Noah's side and said, "Hey, don't worry about it. You've had quite a scare." It was only then that I realized how filthy we all were. When the van had overturned, so had everything in it, including the deli. It was particularly unfortunate that one of us had failed to adequately secure the top of our 2-liter bottle after use. And by the look and smell of things, I surmised that Noah had been soaked in someone's urine during the crash. I supposed that the man comforting him had assumed that the poor kid had somehow lost continence onto his own head, and I briefly contemplated setting the record straight. Bill interrupted my thoughts. "Well, what do you know?" he said brightly. "We've got AAA!" Prior to abandoning our vehicle, he had removed the gas card from the glove box and started reading its fine print. Upon hearing this news, I turned to Bill and grinned in delight.
I'll go phone and get them to yank us out of the ditch,
he said, and walked off toward the payphone.
Tell them we're at the Super 8,
I yelled up to him as I noticed the motel up the block. When Bill came back from the phone, we picked up our backpacks and started walking to the motel. Once inside, we found that the lobby stank so badly that by comparison we had nothing to worry about. I greeted the woman behind the counter.
Hi there. We're going to stay here if you let us.
Single room is 35, double room is 45,
she told me without looking up or removing the cigarette from her mouth. I looked at Terry, who was clearly still in shock.
How about three rooms, I said. Singles for them, and he and I can share,
I added, indicating me and Bill.
$115 total, right?
And tax,
the woman added.
And tax, you bet,
I said with a smile, and timidly provided my credit card. To my surprise, she accepted it and slammed it through the manual system of pressed receipts.
All right, this just gets better and better, I said, and then added, now, who wants dinner?
Terry was sullen.
I just want to go to bed,
she said, and I couldn't tell whether she was angry at me or at herself. I wanted to ask her if she was okay, but then I thought that maybe that wasn't the right thing to do, so I stood there and did nothing, which I also knew wasn't the right thing to do. Noah had disappeared as soon as his room key was in his hand, so Bill and I left the motel and walked down Elm Street looking for a restaurant. We found a greasy steakhouse, ordered two ribeyes and two Cokes, and ate with gusto, only then realizing how hungry we were. The walk back to the motel was a lot like every other walk we'd ever taken together, and yet something had changed. We were like two mobsters who had killed the wrong guy. Something about the whole near-fatal debacle had bound us together forever. We got back to the motel and let ourselves into our room. There was a king-size bed with a grotesquely patterned burgundy quilted bedspread on it, covering sheets that definitely hadn't been changed. The dark paneled walls and heavy polyester curtains reeked of smoke and sweet-smelling disinfectant. The carpet was stained and sticky enough that we kept our boots on. It was late at night, and while my body was beyond exhausted, my mind was still on and glowing. Some bruises had started to make themselves known, and I had seen some blood in my urine when I went to the bathroom at the restaurant, but it hadn't upset me. On that night, I felt like nothing in the world would ever happen again that would be worth getting upset about. Bill and I lay side by side on the bed, staring up at the water-stained ceiling, dimly lit by the room's single desk lamp. The faucet in the bathroom dripped, marking a gentle, steady beat. After about 20 minutes or so, Bill said,
"Well, it's finally happened. One of the students tried to kill us."
The ridiculousness of it all put that way made me giggle. My giggle turned into a laugh. I kept laughing until I was laughing harder and harder from deeper and deeper inside. I laughed until my stomach cramped up and I couldn't breathe properly. I laughed until I couldn't control myself and I wet my pants just a little. I laughed until it hurt so much to laugh that I was begging not to laugh while I was laughing. I laughed until it sounded like I was crying. And Bill laughed too. We laughed out our joy and thanksgiving that we had somehow cheated death and cheated him big time. Our great good luck was a gift from heaven and had revealed a world that was too sweet to leave. We would have another undeserved day and we would have it together. When our laughing finally tapered off, it was because our bodies were exhausted. I rested until I began to giggle again. Then I started to laugh, and Bill laughed too. We did it all over again. We lay side by side, fully clothed, and laughed with our boots on. Bill got up and went into the bathroom, but came out directly, saying, "Guess what, the toilet's clogged. I knew we should have grabbed the bottles as we bailed." "Well, just piss on the carpet," I suggested. "I think that's what people have been doing." He reacted with disgust. "Don't be an animal. The bathtub drains just fine." I got up and took his suggestion, and then we both lay back down, side by side, and continued to stare at the ceiling. "You know, I feel bad about Terry," I confessed. "She probably hates me." "Oh, come on, she should be ecstatic that she's alive," Bill said adamantly. "She should be glad we're all alive," I added with emphasis, but I was troubled. "I'm sure she blames me for this mess. And ultimately, I guess it is my fault. I'm the one who signed her up for the conference in San Francisco." "Well, you made her travel across the country for free in order to meet the people that she'll be trying to get a job from after she graduates? Yeah, you're a bitch, all right. We should have stayed in Atlanta, where I can do all her lab work for her," said Bill, voicing a hard-edged resentment that I hadn't heard before. "She's an adult," he continued. "Shit, she's like 35 or something. That's a hell of a lot more grown-up than we are." "Well, that's not saying much," I countered. "But it's not like anybody gave a crap if I ever went to a conference back when I was a student." I retreated into my own resentments. "Listen, you're never going to be friends with the students, so just get that through your head right now," Bill sighed. "You and I are going to work our asses off, teach them shit over and over, risk our fucking lives for them, and they are going to unfailingly disappoint us. That's the job. That's what we both get paid for." "You're right." I played into his cynicism, but only half-heartedly. "We don't really believe that, do we?" "No, we don't," Bill admitted. "But tonight we do." I lay with my eyes closed and counted the drips, soft and regular, as they fell from the bathroom faucet, until Bill finally said, "But you do know that you can never be friends with the people that you work with." I opened my eyes because his words had unexpectedly stung me. I ventured, "What about us? I mean, we're friends, aren't we?" "Nope," he answered, and then continued, "You and I are just two sorry sons of bitches stranded in the middle of nowhere trying to save $25 on a hotel room. So shut up and go to sleep." And so we did, on opposite sides of the big bed, with our clothes and boots on. I decided that this must be what family feels like, and I thanked God for the day we'd had, and also for tomorrow while I was at it. The next morning we woke up late, and by the time we emerged from our room, it was a clear, sunshiny day. Terry had been waiting for me in the lobby, fuming. It didn't look as if she'd slept at all that night. We walked across the street to the big rig truck stop, and shared a single order of bacon and eggs, which provided more than enough food for four people. After Bill ordered his eighth cup of coffee, Terry looked at me and said, "I want you to take me to the Salt Lake City airport so I can fly back home." I nodded and got ready to tell her that I understood and that it would be no problem. Before I could open my mouth, Bill exploded.
"What?"
He threw his silverware down and grabbed the table as if the very earth were shaking.
"You roll the van, and now your plan is just to bail out of here and leave us to deal with it?"
he asked.
"That is cold. That shit is just fucking cold."
He shook his head, appalled. Terry got up hastily and left, probably to go and cry in the restroom. I considered following her and telling her that everything would be all right, and that everybody makes mistakes, and that the whole trip had been a stupid idea, and that we'd all just go home. But my intuition as a scientist told me that it would be a mistake for us to give up that easily. I sat at the table and thought as the dust was settling. Like everything else in the lab, the accident was ultimately my responsibility, and the buck stopped with me. Last night I'd known that once morning came, I'd have to crawl out of bed and deal with the whole mess, none of which I had even remotely started to sort out. I had no idea where the van was, or my suitcase for that matter. I didn't even really know how close or how far we might be from Salt Lake City. I knew that it was now less than 24 hours until my presentation at the conference, and that we still had to cross 3 entire states to get there. But mostly I was just glad to be sufficiently alive to get to try to solve these problems. I didn't foresee anything that might kill me that day, and not getting killed was my new bar for what constituted a good day. There was nothing for it but to eat some bacon and then improvise. Although I agreed that pushing forward was the right thing to do, Bill's reaction had surprised me. I slowly realized that he might have considered, yet never acted upon, the idea of abandoning me. And it dawned on me for the first time that he actually had the option of bailing out of his life in Georgia. Bill had taken this latest bizarre and scary episode in his usual stride, and saw no way out but to put his head down and burrow out of the huge catastrophe that he'd had no part in creating. In fact, none of this had even seemed to bother him. The thing that did bother him was that someone else might consider abandoning us. The very idea enraged him in a way that all the frustrating situations we had ever encountered could not. I finished the thought that I had started before I fell asleep. This is my life, and Bill is my family. The students will come and go. They'll be what they are, some hopeful and some hopeless, but we won't get attached. This is about me and Bill and what we can do together. All the rest of it is nothing more than background noise. I released myself from the lofty, boastful, greedy expectations of academia. I wasn't going to change the world, or educate a new generation, or glorify an institution. It was about being in the lab and keeping it all together, body and soul. When I crawled out of that van alive, I checked my pockets and found only one currency that mattered, loyalty. I got up, paid at the register, and then held the door open for everyone as we left. "Come on, gang. This'll get better," I told them. "It has to." As we all walked back to the motel, I saw what looked like our van in the parking lot, but I decided that it couldn't be because it was in perfect condition. As we got closer, we found that it did look perfect, if you looked at only the passenger's side. The other side was caved in like a crumpled beer can, and the driver's side mirror was nowhere to be seen, having snapped off along with one of the windshield wipers. However, none of the windows were broken, and all of the doors on the passenger's side opened and closed normally. Bill opened the van, looked inside, and commented on its understated luxury. The deli had flown open during the crash, and the interior reeked of piss, spoiled lunch meat, and rancid cheese. Filth was stuck to the windows on one side because the whole mess had settled and frozen while the van had lain in the ditch all the previous night. Bill announced that our suitcases were all there and plopped himself down in the driver's seat to try the engine. He turned the key and the engine immediately roared to life and purred while it idled. I saw Bill's face break into a huge smile. "We're in business," he shouted. I held my nose and hopped up into shotgun position while Terry and Noah crawled into the 2 back seats. We returned to the highway and drove west toward Rock Springs, Wyoming, with Noah acting as the driver's side view mirror, silently signaling when the road was open. It occurred to me that he hadn't spoken a word during the whole trip. I put my seatbelt on and checked it several times to make sure that the mechanism had caught. We pulled onto the highway, and I calculated how many hours we were from San Francisco. 16, maybe 17 at the most. We'd just make it. I didn't count on the blizzard that was raging in the Sierras, but that wouldn't become an issue until later. For the moment, everything looked good. Bill suddenly exclaimed, "Oh, shit, we forgot to pull over and look for the side mirror." Then he added, "Oh, well, we can do it on the way back." I was stunned. I had been so focused upon just getting to San Francisco, I hadn't even thought about the fact that we were going to have to drive this broken thing all the way back across the country. I started to say something about it. As if reading my mind, Bill pointed at me and said, "Nope, I don't want to hear it. You just sit there and think about your presentation." Then he added, "After all we've been through, it had better be good." Compared with the trip there, the 5-day conference seemed uneventful, and as soon as it ended, we drove back to Atlanta, this time via first I-10 and then I-20, which included Arizona, New Mexico, and 200 miles of Texas sans map. Each day, Bill observed that the country was beautiful, and I agreed. By the time we got to Phoenix, Terry was fully herself again, and bygones were bygones. I returned the van late in the evening after we arrived in Atlanta, shoved the keys in the rental pool's after-hours box, and walked away. Within a month, every administrator at the university was absolutely furious with me. I insisted that it had been me behind the wheel, and reassured them again and again of my complete lack of remorse, arguing that I was far too grateful to be alive to find fault with whatever miracle had granted us safety. They didn't get it, and I finally stopped expecting them to. There was one person who did get it, who got all of it, and I had finally fully realized how damn lucky I was to have him along. Chapter 11. The little town of Sitka is probably the most inviting place in Alaska. It sits on Baranof Island, facing the Gulf, and is kept maternally mild by the warm currents of the Pacific Ocean. The monthly average temperature never drops below freezing, making the climate benignly hospitable for the few thousand people who live there. Not much has ever happened in Sitka, except for a few days in 1867, when the whole world focused upon it briefly. The Alaska Purchase occurred in Sitka, replete with a formal ceremony featuring both the Russian, sellers, and the American, buyers, diplomats. They were celebrating a treaty ratified by the U.S. Senate, under which the United States purchased 500,000 square miles of new territory at a cost of 2 cents an acre. The total sum that changed hands, $7 million, represented an exorbitant figure to the average American facing the rubble left over from the Civil War, which had only just ended. Opinions were divided. Those in favor argued that British Columbia could be strategically annexed as a next step. Those opposed despaired that the acquisition merely burdened America with more unpopulated territory to fill. In post-Civil War America, the treaty also served as escapist drama, yet another battle between good and evil, this time conducted in a strange land, far away. A second great drama unfolded in Sitka in the 1980s, but it wasn't a treaty between nations. It was a war between species. Trees love Sitka. The long, light summers, coupled with the mild climate, make Baranof Island a darn fine place to live and grow, even if the cold, dark winters prevent the plants from growing very large. There's a Sitka spruce, a Sitka alder, a Sitka ash, and a Sitka willow, all first identified during the exploration of the region. These Sitka trees have successfully colonized British Columbia, along with the states of Washington, Oregon, and California. And yet they are modest trees. The Sitka willow, in particular, is not an imposing plant. It reaches a maximum height of 23 feet. Not exactly a forest giant. But with the Sitka willow, as with all plants, there is much, much more than meets the eye. Whenever you stroll through a eucalyptus grove, you are engulfed in a unique smell, acrid and spicy, and a little bit soapy, too. What you are actually sensing is an airborne chemical that is created and released by the trees. A volatile organic compound, or VOC for short. The VOCs were synthesized to be secondary compounds. This means that they don't provide any nutrition, and so they are secondary to basic life functions. VOCs have many uses that we do understand, and probably a host of others that we do not. The eucalyptus releases VOCs as part of an antiseptic that will keep its leaves and bark healthy if it is wounded, preventing infection. Most VOC compounds don't contain nitrogen, thus they are relatively cheap for the plant to produce and are therefore expendable. There's no real downside for a tree to pump VOCs through the forest in lavish excess, giving rise to that characteristic eucalyptus smell recognizable to a human nose. In contrast, the vast majority of VOCs that trees produce cannot be detected by the human nose, which is just fine because that is not what they are for. The production of VOCs within a forest waxes and wanes because individual VOC compounds can be turned on and off with a signal. One common signal is jasmonic acid, which is produced copiously when a plant is wounded. In the war between plants and insects that has been raging for 400 million years, both sides have had their casualties. In 1977, the State University's research forest in King County, Washington, was utterly ravaged by an insect attack. Tent caterpillars led the charge. They are brutal and insatiable warriors, and were able to completely defoliate several entire trees and fatally damage many more before they triggered a crash in the local tree population across many broadleaf species. We all know that it is possible to lose a battle and still win the war, and nowhere do we find this to be more true than in the history of trees. In 1979, back in the laboratory at the University of Washington, researchers fed leaves from the trees that had survived the attack to tent caterpillars and then carefully watched them eat. They observed that these caterpillars grew much more slowly and sickly than caterpillars generally do, and they certainly did not grow as well as they had grown on the same trees only 2 years earlier. Simply put, there was some chemical in the leaves that was making them sick. The really exciting thing, however, was that the healthy Sitka willow trees located a full mile away, trees that had never been attacked, were equally unpalatable to the tent caterpillars. Indeed, when fed the leaves of the distant and healthy trees, the caterpillars became just as feeble and sickly and were rendered incapable of destroying a forest, as they had done so easily over the hill just 2 years previously. The scientists knew about root-to-root signaling between adjacent trees via underground secretions, but the two groups of Sitka willow were too far separated for any soil talk to have taken place. No, some above-ground signal must have been transmitted and received. The scientists concluded that when the leaves were first wounded, the plant began to load them with caterpillar poison, which also triggered VOC production. They further hypothesized that the VOC must have traveled at least a mile and was sensed as a distress signal by the other trees, which then preemptively fortified their leaves with caterpillar poison. Through the 1980s, Generation after generation of caterpillars died miserable, starving deaths due to these poisons. By playing this long game, the trees ultimately turned the tide of the war. Given their years of observations, the researchers were convinced that above-ground signaling among the trees was the most likely explanation. They knew that trees aren't people, and that they don't have feelings. For us, they don't care about us. But maybe they care about each other. Maybe during a crisis, the trees take care of each other. The Sitka Willow experiment was a beautiful, brilliant piece of work that changed everything. There was only one problem. It took more than 20 years for anyone to believe it. Chapter 12. I could fall asleep, but I couldn't stay asleep. Off and on for several weeks during the early spring of 1999. I'd awaken at about 2:30 in the morning and become increasingly agitated over my inability to get back to sleep. Bill ran the lab beautifully, and each experiment succeeded like clockwork, which made it all the more frustrating when each of my proposals for grant contracts was rejected, one after the other. In order for a contract to be approved, it must pass a stringent peer review. Evaluation is heavily slanted toward track record, the number of significant discoveries that have resulted from previous contracts. Thus, a brand new researcher is at a serious disadvantage. It is also not uncommon for scientists to work out their personal issues under the guise of making an evaluation. And I was receiving feedback along the lines of, "This reviewer is dismayed to find that the investigator's apparent capabilities were deemed sufficient to merit a graduate degree from the very same institution that produced his own credentials," and other useless venom. During the San Francisco conference that we had nearly killed ourselves getting to, and at which I had presented my ideas about plants and water uptake, an enraged senior scientist, who years later betrayed himself to be a nice person, had stood on a folding chair and yelled, "I can't believe you are saying this," while I tried to speak. In my shock and confusion, I had stuttered, "Something is wrong with you," into the microphone, and it hadn't rendered the atmosphere more congenial. To be fair, the trouble had really started years earlier. While taking a break from writing my dissertation, I visited a new professor whose recent arrival I had long anticipated because of her singular expertise in paleobotany. I helped her to unpack her large collection of fossils and sort, label, and store them. The rocks contained traces of the Earth's earliest flowers, and she had collected them at great personal risk within the jungles outside of Bogota, Colombia. These sediments were 120 million years old. And my colleague planned to extract the tiny pollen grains and fern spores that had collected underneath the fossilized petals. After examining them under the microscope, she would meticulously describe the shape of each grain she found and keep a record of how the number of grains changed between rocks. Using the statistics generated, she could then discern how the appearance of flowers had been related to changes in fern populations, and measure the amount of shade that was present in the dark understory that had fomented a botanical revolution. The rock samples were jagged and crumbly, and so dark that I wondered aloud if they might still contain enough organic carbon to be measurable on a mass spectrometer. I ran some test samples, and found more than enough. In fact, there was even enough carbon to perform a new type of chemical analysis, a technique that would measure the ratio of heavy carbon atoms to more normal, everyday carbon nuclei. Our work turned out to be some of the first analyses of carbon-13 within ancient terrestrial rocks, and though I was able to finish the lab work in less than 2 years, it ended up taking me 6 full years to interpret the data and finally publish my findings. Thus my early years as a professor were spent trying to persuade the world that I had used an unusual method on unorthodox samples to gain a surprising result via an untested interpretation. The whole thing had come out of left field, and I was naive in thinking that I could win over audiences who had decades more research credibility than I did. My early career had all the makings of a long, slow academic train wreck. As I spent those early years repeatedly smashing against a brick wall of scholarly skepticism, my bewilderment ripened into the realization that it would take me many conferences, much correspondence, and a great deal of intellectual soul-searching to successfully convince a critical mass of other scientists that I knew what I was doing. The trouble was, I didn't have years. After I ran out of the money that the university had allotted for the startup of my lab, we began appropriating chemicals, gloves, test tubes, and anything that wasn't nailed down from the dusty abandoned basement of the building in order to keep working. My transparent justifications to the tune of, at least I'm using it for something, had begun to ring hollow as our desperation drove us to scour the dumpsters, recycling bins, and finally the teaching labs within the engineering buildings, where they seemed to be so rich in everything we told ourselves that they couldn't possibly miss this or that. The money to pay Bill's salary was the last to run out. And though he always made a great show of indignation and moral offense when a student finally worked up the nerve to ask him whether he was that guy who lives in the building, the whole situation was beginning to wear on both of us. At first, Bill regarded his destitution as a novel adventure, a temporary bohemian phase, but it lost its meager charms as the months dragged on. Throughout the time he was homeless, my small gestures, such as cooking him dinner every night, were enough to offset much of my guilt. But lately it had become clear that I was ruining both of our lives. I was also existentially terrified. Ever since I was a little girl, I had longed to be a real scientist. And so soon after finally getting close, I was in danger of losing it all. I was working extra hours, but the inefficient all-nighters weren't helping much. While investigating a light that he assumed had been carelessly left on, the night custodian muttered upon finding me, "However much you love your job, it ain't gonna love you back," and shook his head in pity as he closed my office door. I didn't want to agree, but I was beginning to see his point. The nightmare of losing the lab was all the more horrifying because it had been my only concrete dream. During my college years, I had latched onto the idea that once I was a bona fide scholar, the main manifestation of that idea being a laboratory with my name on the door, everyone would acknowledge my credibility, some scientific breakthrough would logically follow, and life would be easy. I had raced through graduate school secure in my expectation of this reward. Thus I was bewildered by my failure during these early years of professorship and deeply worried, for the first time, that my cosmic destiny would go unfulfilled, and the faith of my frustrated foremothers, whom I always pictured scrubbing bedclothes while up to their elbows in lye, had been wasted on me. During the anxious melodrama of those sleepless nights, I'd start thinking about St. Stephen, the poor bastard. How he started out all full of piss, vinegar, and the Holy Spirit, but hadn't even gotten out of Jerusalem before his audience strung him up on the outskirts of town. Only a few days before that, Stephen was picked as one of the lucky seven who were expected to go forward and speak the gospel. Did they explain to Stephen that there was a very real chance that he'd enrage people with his great new take on things? Of course he was supremely pious and all that, but didn't he feel like a bit of a sucker nonetheless? The Bible is always short on details. Didn't Stephen's innate sense of self-preservation thwart his martyrdom at all? When someone throws a stone at your head, don't you instinctively dodge it? Put your arms up? Or do you close your eyes and let it happen, waiting for a good hard smack to the temple. And where did the stones come from, anyway, when they stoned people? Did people collect them on the way to the scene? About how many stones did each thrower figure that he needed? Did they examine each one they picked up, discarding and retaining them based on some criterion? Did women get to throw too, or did they just simper on the periphery, as depicted by Raphael? I thought about Saul, the elder who oversaw the whole grisly affair, and how he eventually came around to Stephen's way of thinking, and gained no small amount of celebrity roaming the empire and espousing it, but only after Stephen was good and dead. With my mind thus running in pointless circles, I get more nervous and then unbearably achy, starting with my knees and elbows and spreading to my ankles and shoulders. I'd sit on the edge of my bed, kneading my joints and rocking back and forth for a half hour or so, and when I couldn't stand it any longer, I'd call Bill. The ancient phone on the wall of the office where he slept had a ring not unlike an old fire alarm, and he'd answer quickly, more out of an urge to silence it than out of concern for me.
"Is it the witching hour already?"
he said when he picked up the phone.
"I don't feel so good,"
I muttered in a shaky voice that betrayed my cascading anxiety.
"You sound like shit. Have you eaten anything since you dropped me off?" "I drank some Ensure,"
I offered, and he sighed in exasperation. There was a long pause. After a while, he groaned and said,
"I guess this is the part where I tell you that it is all going to be fine."
I was trying not to break down.
"But what if it isn't? What if I never get a grant? What if I'm just not smart enough? What if we lose everything?"
I rambled in agitation.
"What if? Fuck what if? None of that shit will change anything," Bill hollered. "What if you don't get a grant? You can't exactly pay me less than you do now, in case you haven't run the numbers lately. What if you get fired? We've got the goddamn keys to the place. I'll go make copies tomorrow. I've developed a nagging suspicion that you don't have to be employed here to come in and work every day. You just keep putting on that power suit and hawk our wares at those interviews and get us out of here, for God's sake. If we built this shit once, we can build it twice. Or we'll roll up the goddamn tent during the night and just disappear. You can grind the organ in the next town over while I run around tipping my bellboy's hat and rattling coins in a tin cup." By then I was laughing weakly, soothed by his admonitions. There was a long silence. "Shall we have a reading from the Book of Marcy?" I offered.
"Finally you begin to talk sense," Bill assented, and I dug the thick volume out from under my bed and flipped it open to a random page. We had nicknamed one of my recent master's students Marcy, after her own favorite Peanuts character. In the end, however, she proved to be more like Peppermint Patty, tending toward the same good-natured resignation with respect to her multiple D-minuses. She had recently left the lab on decent terms, having decided against improving her work enough to make it passable. Her parting gift to us was the draft of a thesis that had swollen grotesquely with each revision, and I kept arguing that it heralded an emergent literary style. Everything about it was ridiculous, from its 14-point Palatino font to the unfortunate fact that some of the pages had been shuffled in upside down prior to binding. While we waited out my insomnia, I read a 3-page paragraph of Marcy's nonsense, and followed it with a section of Finnegan's Wake. Then I asked Bill to identify which one was which, and to justify his determination through critical analysis. The night before, I had compared and contrasted the methods section of the Book of Marcy with the famous Lucky's Think monologue from Waiting for Godot. Anticipating the singular catharsis that comes of conspiring in something despicable, Bill and I provoked each other with feigned erudition. Lately, these long bantering phone conversations with Bill had become the only thing that could harness my racing thoughts so that I might sleep. A break in our conversation led to a long pause, and when I looked out the window, I could see no indication of a sunrise. I checked the clock and said, "Wow, 4 a.m., and I think we're there. New record." My anxiety had subsided. "You know what's the worst part of this for me? It's that I'm sure you are keeping the beast up, damn it," lamented Bill. I looked over at Reba, who was indeed lying in her basket at the foot of my bed, quietly awake and watchful. Another long pause followed. "Cripes, why don't you go to a doctor or something?" Bill asked me, in a voice that was almost tender. I laughed off his suggestion. "No money, no time, and for what?" I answered. "So he can advise me to reduce my stress level?" "So he can prescribe you some fucking Prozac."
I don't need it," I said.
Bill's answer came quickly.
"Then don't take it," he said. "Give it to the homeless guy who lives in your laboratory."
A new wave of guilt crashed over me as I realized that this was as close as Bill had ever come to admitting to me that he was unhappy.
"I'll think about it," I promised.
I put my hand over the mouthpiece so Bill wouldn't hear me choke back what I wanted to say. Finally, I gave voice to part of it and said softly,
"Thank you for picking up when I called."
"That's why you pay me the big bucks," said Bill, and then he hung up.
Things would get better. 6 months later, we rented a moving van, packed it with scientific equipment, loaded Reba into the front seat, fastened our seat belts for a change, and drove north toward Baltimore. I had secured new jobs for both of us at Johns Hopkins and convinced the two universities that it made more sense to simply transfer laboratory instruments than to discard them. After we moved, I took Bill's advice and went to the doctor. I got on the right medications and started eating healthy and sleeping regularly, and I got stronger. Bill quit smoking. We both kept working, kept pounding on doors, and kept believing that eventually they would have to start opening. Love and learning are similar, in that they can never be wasted. I left Atlanta knowing more than I had when I arrived. To this day, I need only close my eyes to summon the smell of a crushed sweet gum leaf, as pungent as if I were holding it in my hand. Point to any object in my laboratory, and I can tell you how much I paid for it down to the penny, and which company sells the cheapest version. I can explain the theory of hydraulic lift so that every single student in the room understands it on the first go-round. I know that there is more deuterium in soil water from Louisiana than there is in soil water from Mississippi, although I am only about halfway done figuring out why. And because I know the transcendent value of loyalty, I've been to places that a person can't get to any other way. Part 3. Flowers and Fruit. Chapter 1. For several billion years, the whole of the Earth's land surface was completely barren. Even after life had richly populated the oceans, there is no clear evidence for any life on land. While herds of trilobites wallowed on the ocean floor, preyed upon by Anomalocaris, a segmented marine insect the size of a Labrador retriever, there was nothing on land. Sponges, mollusks, snails, corals, and exotic crinoids maneuvered through near-shore and deep-water environments. Still nothing. The first jawed and jawless fishes appeared and radiated into the bony forms we know today. Still nothing. 60 million more years passed before there was life on land that constituted any more than a few single cells stuck together within the cracks of a rock. Once the first plant did somehow make its way onto land, however, it took only a few million years for all of the continents to turn green.